You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, back after a little hiatus, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. This is Monday, December 6th, 2010, and today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview with Vermont poet Pamela Harrison. Pamela Harrison is an American poet and educator. She's the author of five poetry collections, most recently Out of Silence, published by David Robert Books. Her poems have been published in literary journals and magazines, including Poetry, Beloit Poetry Journal, Georgia Review, Green Mountains Review, Cimarron Review, and Yankee Magazine. And she has received fellowships from the McDowell Colony and the Vermont Studio Center. And in 2002, Pamela Harrison received the Penn Northern New England Discovery Poet Award. She teaches English literature and creative writing for the University System of New Hampshire and Dartmouth College, and she lives in Norwich, Vermont, with her husband, Dennis McCullough. Pamela Harrison's collection, Out of Silence, is deeply rooted in the place of her childhood, in addition to the circumstances of her family. And when I spoke to her last month, I began by asking her to talk about the area of the country where she was raised.
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma City, right?
Yes.
Was it right in the city, or was it?
Well, it was in a suburb just slightly north of the city. Yeah, okay. It was a suburban existence. And there were, when I was growing up, there were lots of vacant lots in the area, so we dug forts and, you know, did all the things that kids do.
Now, how old were you when you left Oklahoma City?
When I went off to college, 18
and
years old.
Where did you go to school?
To Smith College. And that was a big adventure because I'm ashamed to say that I went there because my brother wanted me to go there because he was at Yale and he thought his girlfriend was at Smith and he thought that that was the best place. And so I wasn't conscious at that time anyway. I didn't wake up until the beginning of my junior year. I think that's when I finally realized what an opportunity I'd been given and I'd better start using it.
That's nice that you discovered it while you were still in college.
Yes.
I think a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they go back to school in their 40s and think, wow, what, I wasted so much time.
And then they become fantastic, you know, students, because it's so precious by then.
Right, yeah. Now, how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have an older brother who is the medical student in Winter's Tale, mm-hmm. and he had been an English major at Yale, and that's where that came in later.
Okay.
And my younger sister is 2.5 years younger, and she lives in Annapolis, is enjoying a recent retirement from her 9-to-5 job.
Okay. Well, let's just start by talking about this collection as a whole. How long did you work on Out of Silence?
Oh, my goodness. This book has been 30 years in the writing. The interesting thing was that it's very closely associated with my sense of being a poet at all, because I had been accepted into the Goddard MFA program.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to prepare something. The first session was going to start in the winter, and I had to prepare two poems for that. And suddenly, in sort of thinking, out of my subconscious came all of this repressed material that I honestly hadn't thought about for years. And it presented with the poem, with the dream that became the poem, Enter Here, walking down that spiral staircase to the hidden depths. And it became where the ripples start. It became that poem that was, I considered, a kind of cork poem. It unlocked a whole room of memory and emotion that I had been afraid to look at and wasn't prepared to look at. And somehow poetry itself gave me a mechanism, because it brought me so close to words again in that way. Mm-hmm. So it became part of that whole endeavor to try to be a poet and try to find words for what I was thinking and feeling. And so that was when things began.
Now, had you worked in some field before then?
Oh, I had been a high school teacher in Boston, and then English as a second language, and trying to find my way forward. Had I begun working? I don't think I'd even begun teaching for UNH at that point. I taught English and creative writing and English literature for the School for Lifelong Learning for some years.
So you taught creative writing before you actually started trying to write on your own creatively?
Well, I didn't. I was teaching literature.
Okay.
But part of that was creative writing, because one of the ways I would entertain my students in high school was I would write parodies of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight and Beowulf and all of these other literary things, Henry IV Part 1 that we were studying. I would just do that for fun, but I hadn't really claimed. I loved poetry. I've loved poetry and the English language. It was what got me through high school. It was what got me to college. But I had no artistic models whatsoever, and neither parent actually went to college. Neither of my parents went to college, so I didn't have the sense that, well, you could try writing this yourself. You know, it seemed like it was just way beyond me for a long time.
Yeah.
Until I finally backed into a situation where I thought, there's nothing I can do except write this down as a poem. Try to write it as a poem. So by that time, I was married and had a daughter who was 2 years old. Mm. And I was writing on the kitchen table the way so many young writers begin. And I went to the Frost Place and heard Ellen Voigt talk. And I knew right then that I really wanted to go to Goddard, because at that time she was at Goddard.
Okay.
So my application arrived after she had taken everybody south to Warren Wilson. And
where did you live at this time?
I lived down in Canaan, New Hampshire at that point, on a little farm in Canaan. We were raising pigs and sheep and going back to the land. And, and my husband was a family practitioner who was working every day and every other night. It was a very busy time with our little two-year-old.
Oh, it sounds like the perfect time to go back to school.
Yes, it was. It was a challenge. I knew I couldn't go any further than 2 hours away, really, basically. So it was wonderful when Roger called up, Roger Weingarten, who took over the program again after Ellen and everybody left, and started it up again. And so we met the first time at Goddard, and I have to tell you, Goddard at that time, I mean, what did I know? It was a ghost town. Most of the buildings were boarded up. They had fallen on hard financial times, and the adult degree programs that they had were, I think, the only money-making part of the school at that time. And so by the time so I went there for my winter residency with Jack Myers and Leslie Ullman and Roger. And then by the summer, the program had been sold to Vermont College, and then we met during the summer and subsequent, and I graduated.
On the different campus, then?
On the different campus, yeah. It was suddenly Vermont College MFA.
Okay.
So that was fine.
Yeah.
I loved the campus, and I loved coming to Montpelier.
Yeah.
So that was good.
When you started to have a group of poems that would eventually come together in this collection, did you recognize that they were all of a piece? Were you trying to create a single larger work?
Well, for the longest time, because I was still immature as a poet and a person, I think, for the longest time, the only poems that came were ones in the voice of the little girl who experienced all of that. And I would write them when they came, and they got put somewhere, in a stack of failed efforts, and I just wasn't ready. And ultimately, I had to wait for both my mother and my father to die. Now, my mother died in 1985, and Dad passed away in 2000, and I needed even then to wait to grow up a little more, and also to be sure that if I were to bring the story out, I wouldn't hurt anybody that would be still around.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been very careful. I tried to be very careful about that.
Did your father ever read any of your poems?
It was wonderful. After my mother died, a lovely woman whom I considered a tremendous role model, who was a companion of my father's in his later life, He lived for 15 years after mother died, single. And this is the woman that he actually, after 10 years or so, proposed to, but she wouldn't marry him. She was a single woman, and they, she thought they were doing better with him here and her there. And so, but she, when my second book came out, Oki Chronicles, which Oki Chronicles is a domestic comedy. It's also a sequenced story about a couple, Leon and Betty, who are having infertility problems, and infidelity. His infidelity is the clutch of the circumstances that, that are the sort of crisis point in the book. But I wasn't ready to write the essential tragedy that Out of Silence was. I needed to write the comedy with a happy ending first.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made it fictional. I created this character, Leon and Betty, and they lived on. And I also wanted to pay tribute to my parent, to my mother's family, who were a farming family in Oklahoma, and quite poor, but hardworking and with lots of integrity. So I just combined that all together and made fictional characters and got to deal with, you know, issues that that I wasn't ready to deal with seriously and in my own story, so I made that up. But by the time, you know, I think 3 years ago, I began to realize that I could begin to write this. I could see the scope of it. I could see where the child poems only went so far.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, I was also ready to deal with my mother's long death from cancer and could do that in a more adult way. And, you know, by that time I was also well grown and had made mistakes as a wife and mother that I could understand her position so much better.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I was ready to tell the story without taking sides.
Okay.
Which I think is the gift of maturation in many ways. When people were as basically good and kind as my mother and father were, I wanted to make sure that I was going to tell it fairly.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that that's when I could really articulate my adult voice and perspective a little better. And then I realized in the writing that suddenly there was a third part to the book. The first two sections were my folks' early married life and the difficulties that they had, and then this middle section is my mother dying from cancer. And then the final section, I realized, was a Bildungsroman. I needed to explain how their troubles, because this is what I came to understand while I was writing their troubles, how that propelled me toward poetry. I finally got the coin dropped, and I realized where all of that urgency and desire came from.
Right.
And I could then try to explore that a little bit.
And so did you, and I want to get to reading some of the poems, but I'm wondering if you recognized that there were three sections after you'd already written poems that would fit into those three sections.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And I didn't know that the third section was a section, but there were lots of poems, and it began to fall out that where they went.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I tried, actually, in putting the book together, I tried to keep the poems of me as a little girl to a minimum, because I really felt very strongly that it was my, but I needed to have her in there because she was the perceiver who was going to hold the tale together.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to put a little bit of her circumstance in there so that I could then, in the third section, deal with the consequences.
Well, I don't know if this is what you intended, but I find her to be a very strong and compelling presence in the collection, and I don't know that I can imagine it without her, actually.
Yeah. Oh, no, I can't either, because she became the perceiver. I became so, that child became so fixated on my mother and
watching her
and feeling, you know, the household was awash in unspoken feeling.
Mm.
And I became the antenna that was resonating to all of those feelings. And I think maybe that's what writers do.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
mm-hmm.
we become the perceivers that other people are too caught up in daily living to be. And we're the watchers. I think Louise Glück talks about it being the watcher. And I do think truly that that's when that event of my mother's attempted suicide was the moment at which I became a watcher.
Mm-hmm.
And tied very closely in focus onto her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I really feel that I felt because she had no words. I had to have them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was an enormous propulsion.
Yeah, yeah.
And words and the spoken, the truth that could be found to fit, you know,
right,
what the feelings were, became a way, a lily pad, really, out of the swamp of all of that roiling emotion toward something that might be true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it worked for me.
Well, I think that it would be great if you could read some of your poetry. I'm wondering if you could read the one called Little Curls of Steam.
Yes. Little Curls of Steam. Water trickled softly from her washcloth, and little curls of steam clouded the mirror. I perched after school on the toilet's closed top, and we talked in the warm tiled room. Mother bathed with practiced care, pushing back the cuticle on each finger and toe, freeing the pale moon's risen there, her head bent to the work like prayer. After all these years, still, the sound of water falling, fragrance of ivory soap, the unembarrassed grooming of a woman who never flinched in her nakedness, who lived in her deepest heart, sequestered.
Thank you very much. This is one of the early poems in the collection, and because I read it early on as I started Out of Silence, I formed an idea of your mother as a confident woman who was comfortable with herself. And then sort of through the experience of reading the collection and through understanding a little bit more about the things that happened to her, maybe that idea of her in my head changed a little bit as I went. But I'm just curious if that's why you put the poem up front, to let readers see her as you remember her from when you were very small, before all the troubles.
Yes, yes. She was the person who was in charge at home. My father was a general practitioner as well, and so his days were long, and she was so competent. They had met when he was in medical school, and she had been the sort of head surgical nurse in the operating room where he was learning how to operate. And she was an incredibly competent woman. She was a perfectionist as well, and I think that I wanted to show how strong she could be, because she shouldered so much in silence, you know. And I came later to understand the incredible sense of will and kindness joined that represented later on in life, when I came to understand the larger story. So yes, I did want to have you have that impression of her that way, because she was. But one of the great mysteries is, if she was so strong, and her childhood showed her also as being someone who was very strong, she was the middle child of seven farming kids. She used to steal her older brother's clothes so that she could have permission to, so that she could pass, you know, to go picking cotton the way that her older brothers did. She taught herself how to speak standard American English as opposed to Oklahoma twang by listening to the radio, and therefore taught all of us how to speak that way instead of talking like this, which is how they talk in Okie Chronicles, which is the story of the farming group.
Right.
Not to make, I mean, you know, accents are a big part of my life, and that's why the diction of that first book is very simple and country western. But we spoke, she was a lover of words. She went to the dictionary to look up the meanings of words, and I wanted to have all of those strengths in there somehow, because the mystery to me is, how did she get into this situation where she seemed to feel she had so few options?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
One thing that I noticed as I read the book through a second time was in this piece, the mention of her pushing back her cuticles, and another piece in this collection, more than one, in fact, refer to the way that your father pressed on the half moons of your mother's fingernails to gauge, if she was alive, or how conscious she was after her suicide attempt. Just in looking at this from a craft perspective, I very much appreciated that in this early poem, you depicted her taking such good care of herself and taking care. I mean, the fingernails are almost sort of a metaphor for how well she takes care of herself and then eventually doesn't, you
yes.
know, when she's
yes.
feeling very desperate.
Yes. But even then, you know, one of the remarkable facts that I remember so vividly as a child was how beautifully she presented herself on the bed, having taken the pills mm. that might have killed her. I think she didn't want to frighten us. I think she wanted it to be as peaceful as it could be.
Hmm.
I can't imagine, because she never spoke about it to us. You know, all of this is an imaginative construct, but I think she honestly didn't want to frighten us as much as she possibly could, and yet she had to give that cri de cœur. I think it was a cry for help and attention and you know, please, I can't do this anymore,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know. But the irony was that the family was such that we didn't talk about it. There was no chance for her to, in my knowledge, ever to talk about it, because my father was the general practitioner for the whole community.
So it couldn't become fodder for gossip. It couldn't become known in the world you lived in.
No.
Because his credibility rode on it, on his story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're talking about your father, so I would love to read maybe a more lighthearted poem, actually. if you wouldn't mind reading Mom Called Him Zeke.
Yes. Now, this poem took place later in their mm. marriage than the very early part, and was at a happier time. Mom called him Zeke. Cut through with the sawing of 17-year cicadas, the heavy heat of August was Dad's favorite time for mowing. Sporting cracked leather shoes, paint-spattered pants, faded baseball cap and holey shirt, he cut the corners square. A woman with big hair drove slowly down Hillcrest, turned in the neighbor's drive and drove slowly back, studying the back, side, and front yards, before turning onto Pennington and pulling in the driveway, where Lynn, drenched in sweat, was bending to fill the gas tank of his orange, grass-matted, self-propelled Jameson walk-behind mower. She rolled down the air-conditioned Cadillac's window and lowered her sunglasses to look him over. When she asked if he always tended that lawn, he replied, "Yes, ma'am." When she asked how much he got paid for doing the work, he allowed he didn't get paid any money, "but the lady of the house lets me sleep with her from time to time." There was a pause as the woman shot a look at the house, rolled her window up without a word, and screeched away.
Now, in the acknowledgments at the back of the book, you thank your brother for having shared this story with you. How did he know this?
I don't think he witnessed this, but my father loved to tell jokes.
Oh.
And I think he probably stole this one from somebody. I don't know, but it became his, and he loved to laugh. This guy loved to laugh, and so that became something that was so telling about him.
That is so funny. I mean, to the extent that this might be a real story, this woman is so so funny.
You could find him most Saturdays, though, in these you know, dirty old clothes. He loved to mow the lawn. I mean, that was part of his work that he loved to
yeah.
do. So
I was struck by the details in this poem, and actually you use detail beautifully in a lot of your work, but this is really an imaginative work for you because you didn't witness it.
Right.
And there's just such perfect detail. I mean, but of course you would have seen how he dressed to mow the lawn on other occasions, but the cracked leather shoes and the paint-splattered pants and so many wonderful details. How about the title, Mom Called Him Zeke?
That was, you know what, I didn't really realize that until I was going through some papers that my father had in the bedside table after he died. And we were trying to clear the house for it to be sold and everything. And there in his bedside table, written out in his hand, was the words to I'll Be Seeing You.
Oh.
Which was a song that they
yeah.
shared.
Oh my goodness.
And
that must have been kind of hard.
Yes, and a little note to him from her, where she called him Zeke.
Oh.
And I just was so taken with that. I never heard her call him Zeke, but it was her name for him.
It's a great title, particularly because it's not a line in the poem.
Yeah.
And so it's just one more piece of information that we get right up front. I loved it. I'm wondering, Pamela, if you can talk about the cover of the collection.
Ah, yes, this cover. I certainly can. It's such a striking image, and Leah Rothstein took the picture of the little sculpture that's about hand size.
And maybe you can just describe it.
It's a woman's face and neck, and her eyes and mouth and jaw and neck are all crisscrossed with cordage, and her hair, which is really made of, I think, chicken feathers probably, but anyway, it's all sticking out in a sort of electric fashion, and she can't see and she can't speak. And I always thought of her as my muzzled muse. I found this at the Christmas opening of the Ava Gallery down in the Upper Valley where I live. This Christmas before I went to my first residency at Vermont College. And I was just walking through the room, and suddenly this sculpture just grabbed me by the throat, and I bought it on the spot. And she's been hanging on the wall over my desk, no matter where we moved. She's been over my desk for the 30 years that I was trying to write this poem. Oh. And she just, that's my mother. That muzzled muse was my mother, and mm-hmm. And so this book has been an effort to bring out of silence her story.
Mm-hmm.
Her story.
It is. It's quite a striking cover, and it's good to know the story behind it because it's a little frightening.
It is a little frightening. Yes, I think that for those of us who live with words, can you imagine how awful it must
right.
be not to have them?
No, and it's perfect. I mean, and particularly with the out of silence right there underneath it, you know, it's very, it explains, they explain each other, the photograph and the title. As I read this book, I was surprised and also intrigued by the last line of the poem, Father. And I wonder if you could read that one.
Mm-hmm. Father always said, you never have to apologize for what you don't say. If you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. When he played golf, he followed proper rules for throwing clubs. One, straight ahead, so as not to delay play. And two, nothing sidearm that might injure your partners. And three, one try only, to retrieve your driver from a tree. In our Chevrolet, he chauffeured summer tours to see the USA at 90 miles an hour. Triple dips of ice cream passed for lunch. We trailed after him through fogs of sawdust in backwoods furniture factories, stirred the curds and whey of a Tillamook cheese, saluted cavalcades of Hershey Kisses, cartons of Salem menthols, and Wonder Bread's waddable loaves. At General Motors, he drove his own slick-finned monster off the line. He loved laughing himself awake at some funny dream, 2-pound boxes of Mrs. C's nut chocolates, arm massaging his head while he watched TV, telling eye-popping medical marvels at meals, and settling us for bed with his latest yarn of Red Cloud, the Wonder Horse. Before I married, he advised, if you both think you're doing 75% of the work, you've half a chance. Dear man, I'm going to tell our deepest secret.
Thank you. So that line, it's just full of the apology and inevitability of what you're about to try and do. What do you think your parents would feel about this?
Oh my goodness, you know,
Do you just not worry about that?
I have to say, I have the blessing of my brother and sister, both of whom felt that I did fair justice to both of them. And my brother, actually, who was an English major too, I think, actually said, you know, you taught me things about the whole thing that I had either not fully seen or registered, so I was very grateful for those commendations for the effort. And my sister was, you know, a tremendous fan. She's been just a wonderful supporter all these years, and is very, I don't think, you know, I don't think it's a happy book for her, reliving all of that, but I think she felt that it was definitely worth, mm-hmm. you know. And I like to think, you know, as I was telling you, I like to think that there are lots of families who have these untold stories, and it's a comfort to share them, because it's so human, you know? It's just so human mm-hmm. to make these mistakes, and telling them, maybe talking about them, at least gives some people some chance to work out some of the difficulties, I think.
Right. I mean, I think in reading this, it struck me so much of this collection is about finding words, finding a way to express what you want to say and bringing it out, and having come from a place of silence where people didn't talk about these things. And it really struck me how much the silence makes something huge, whereas the telling can actually make it more manageable.
And I think for my mother, if she had been able to tell it to someone, you know, I don't know how many of her, I don't know if she even felt free to tell it to friends, because you know how things would get around that way. So I think it would have helped her a lot if she had been able to talk about it. Mm-hmm. In those days, you know, counseling wasn't as common at all. You sort of dealt with your problems stoically by yourself, and that was certainly the case, as in my understanding about where things stood. There weren't a whole lot of people getting, you know, analyzed in Oklahoma City at that time, I don't think.
Right. What years are these, probably?
Well, that's a wonderful question. My brother and I have gone back and forth on this, and my sister. We cannot figure out exactly how old we were. I think that I was somewhere between 9 and 11 when it happened. But that's the best that we've been able to do.
Mm-hmm. As I read about your coming to terms with telling these stories and finding a language for them, I wondered, and you did sort of touch on this, I think, if you went through a period of having lost memories of this time, and if writing brought things back.
It definitely did. And as I say, this dream just absolutely acted like a cork. I knew immediately what the dream was about, and I knew what it was that was sort of knocking at my consciousness to be re-looked at, I think. And I don't know, I think, you know, maybe each of us is given one story to tell. Maybe this is my one story.
It sounds like you've had a few, though.
I do have a few. My father was a storyteller, you know, and so I think that gene is in the family.
Right. Well, and your mother loved language, so.
And my mother loved language.
The poem, The Sound of Sense, lends a bit more information to the story of this child, this young girl whose parents are having such a difficult time in their marriage, and I'm wondering if you can read The Sound of Sense.
The Sound of Sense. The child wakened, crept downstairs to listen to her parents hissing. Crouched at the kitchen door, she could not make out their words, understood nothing except the anger, their voices strangled with passion and fear. She stayed just long enough to gather the tone of cold division, then stole away up the stairs, avoiding the creaks that lurked in the risers, back to her bed beside her sleeping sister. There, rigid with excitement and dread, she lay, guilty of knowing, hoarding the gift.
Thank you.
You know, The Sound of Sense is Robert Frost's phrase, and he was the first poet to really incorporate this idea of the sound of sense in the composition of his lines. And he knew the emotional quality of language, how it sounded. If you heard it behind a closed door, you can still tell what was going on. You might not know the details. And as a child, you don't really understand the details either. Mm-hmm. But I could certainly tell what was going on. And I like to think of this poem, you know, this having this forbidden fruit of knowledge. You know, I think of the book in many ways as a kind of epistemology. how do we as children come to understand the way the world is put together?
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, when there's so much of it that was hidden away, that was secreted away, how do you do that? Well, you start, that this poem sort of marks the place where that little girl first realized, oh, words are the key.
Mm.
Words are where the real thing lies. And so I wanted to pay tribute to Robert Frost right there, because I really lived that understanding about how feeling sounds.
Yeah. I thought that this poem was a beautiful example of how poems can be autobiographical, but also very universal, because I think children have, I mean, most children have this experience of,
yes,
of overhearing something or putting themselves in a position where they can overhear something, but being terrified of being found out.
Yes.
I loved the line, rigid with excitement and dread and guilty of knowing. That was so perfect.
And that's the expulsion from Eden. You know, what Eve did was she chose knowledge. The driving force of curiosity, the driving force of wanting to know is what propels us, I think, through our lives. And if we get up off our dusts at all, it's because, what's going on there? I've got to know what that's about.
Mm-hmm.
So the book, I think, as a whole, became a kind of epistemology for me,
mm-hmm.
Both to write it and then and as well to live it, to mm-hmm. try to figure out what was going on.
Mm-hmm. I read in an interview that you once described your poems as being in a roughly iambic free verse. So can you talk a little bit about that and how you approach form in your work?
Well, I'm not a very good formalist, I confess. I'm very admiring of those poets who can write in forms. I'm sort of the opinion that that each poem, though, is a product of its occasion. That the language, the diction, the rhythms, the imagery, whatever it is, grows out of that singular occasion. And so my poems don't often ever look alike. I mean, I've put some of them in stanzas, and tried to work out a stanzaic rhythm or tercets or quatrains or whatever the longer forms might be that felt as though it captured the movement of perception in that particular poem. That's mm-hmm. what I'm looking at. And maybe I get that from, I think, William Carlos Williams was trying very hard to orchestrate perception down the vertical space of his poems. But my poems come to me very often as a rhythm. And so that generative rhythm is what gets me launched into a poem. And then I subsequently have to find out, you know, how long are the lines going to be and are there going to be stanzas or whatever. Now, I have noticed as I've gotten older, more and more slant rhyme has come into my work. I don't think I was using the music of sound very much consciously when I was a younger writer, but the older I get, the more I love the affinities that occur between words, and they often have thematic affinities in addition to sound affinities. So I think our language, that's partly why I'm so upset with politics right now, because there's so many people misusing the language for ulterior motives and misinformation. I feel so strongly that language is what we have been given as human beings to be able to talk with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And to the degree that we casually or just carelessly devalue its capacity to speak the truth, then we're going to end up just hallucinating reality, because there's going to be no bridge between the world and our inner lives. Mm-hmm. And that's what language can do. It can bridge not only our own inner life with the outer world, but it can bridge your inner life with my inner life by sharing this complex of the inner world, of the outer world that we share together as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why poetry that's grounded in the earth and grounded in the natural world, we can all relate to in a universal way. And,
sure.
And that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for each poem to be true to its subject and true to its emotion if I can.
Okay.
If there's a form in there, all the better.
Yeah. Okay. I loved the poem, "The Wide World, Just a Rumor." Could you read that one?
I'd be happy to. "The Wide World, Just a Rumor." First, there was the firmament over all, still invisible to herself. The child in her trance floated like Giotto's angels in a frame without a ceiling or a floor, without a shadow in the azure air. Crouching beneath a new formica desk with grubby fingers laced behind her neck, she ducked word of A-bombs and tornadoes. Mickey Mantle won baseball's triple crown, but Russia's Sputnik sliced a scar across October's darkened sky. When her urgent hunger for the undisclosed drove her to open her sister's birthday gift, she was scolded and stormed from the party, swearing to wear a Stevenson pin. Thus the one cracked into its many parts, and difference settled on her like a pall. When it fell to her to explain it all, her small soul, made suddenly visible, glistened in a call of helpless shame.
I love that. Thank you very much. I think this is related to what we were saying before about a child's starting to make sense of the world.
Yes.
Of the world of parents and the world of ourselves and all of the environment that surrounds us. And I loved how at the beginning, still invisible to herself, and then at the end, made suddenly visible, her small soul made suddenly visible. And unfortunately, it's with this helpless shame.
Yes, that she couldn't understand it all. Mm. And that she wasn't up to the task. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that children often feel just, you know, that they're not adequate to what's being asked of them. Mm-hmm. Not that anyone had asked me to make sense of the world, but somehow trying to make sense of, you know, a sort of a cogent narrative line through what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Difficult.
Yeah. The words one and many are capitalized in that line. Thus the one cracked into its many parts. And I just wondered why you decided that those should be capitalized.
Well, I wanted to, this poem very much, I think, points to the idea of an epistemology. And I think children, there's a time when you aren't yet awake as a child, I think, where the world is all one. You're your mother, you're your father, everything is, you know, all of a piece, and it just is the way it is.
And then, and you're very much at the center of it.
You're very much, absolutely at the center of it. And then suddenly something happens to make you feel alone, because you realize, I'm a self, I don't know what that self is, but I'm a self, and you're a self, and we're all different, and we all have different interior lives, and we all have different lives behind the closed doors of our homes.
Mm.
And suddenly, you've begun to take your first steps on that journey toward self-understanding, self-realization,
mm-hmm.
all of those things.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, for you, which I suspect is why it's in this section of the book, you're on that journey to understanding how to put into words your story.
Yes.
Is that?
Yes, absolutely. And that was the beginning. I think that's when I began to love words for themselves.
Mm.
Was when I really realized that the only way out of this is naming whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
you know.
There's a poem in the collection, which I'm not going to ask you to read, but it's called "Where the Ripples Start," and it concerns your mother's suicide attempt again, and the fact, for example, that she tried to commit suicide on piano lesson day, which that detail really struck me. I feel like that's going to make this accessible to about 75% of your readers.
Yes.
We all took piano and we're supposed to be on time.
Well, that's where, you know, what's left of the poem that I wrote for that first residency at the MFA program. And I thought for a long time, well, you know, because my solution at that point was to fictionalize the way that the woman in the story decides to commit her suicide because I didn't know how to deal with.
Is that the bathtub?
The bathtub. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, I think I will put it in because it spoke. The poem also speaks about the inherent guilt that you feel when you're a child. Mm-hmm. You're so narcissistic that you somehow feel you are the center of the universe and that things happen because of you. And I think that that mechanism was something that really propelled me toward watching my mother with a hawk eye about, you know, and because, of course, I was also terrified she'd try it again mm-hmm. and that we'd lose her again. Mm-hmm. So this was, I think, my effort to deal with the emotional residues of guilt mm-hmm. that I felt as a child. That poem stood as the first early failed effort of trying to find words in this story about the mother. And I wanted to bring back the bath. I wanted to bring back mother's bath in the afternoon, but have it replayed by me in this other world where I'm wondering, you know, what could I have done differently or so on.
Which, of course, is nothing because you were 9 years old or 10 years old.
That's right.
My last question is, do you have any specific advice for poets or writers of any kind who might be wrestling with the decision to write about personal histories and family secrets?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about it not being a worthy subject for poetry, all of these, you know, sort of survivor stories and things like mm-hmm. that. But you know what? I think language is too important not to use in stories, telling these stories. And I think that the nature of poetry, the nature of trying to write a poem, is quite a bit different from just telling your story to a TV audience and that kind of thing. I mean, you're trying to tell in the most carefully chosen words that you possibly can. And it may be that when you write a poem, that's not one that's going to be for publishing. Maybe you just wrote that to get yourself a little further along the path. I gave myself permission to write this story because I waited long enough to be an adult to write it. I tried very hard to charged myself with the job of writing it fairly in a loving fashion, because I feel that love, it is a love story, and love underwrites everything that happens in the book. And I feel that people who haven't yet come to language deserve the right of using it when they can find it. If you have lived without being respected for your voice, if you have lived in a state of muzzled understanding, then it is absolutely right that you come and witness to your experience. I mean, that's what witnessing is all about. And frankly, so much of our literature is about families who have run on some rocks and how do they work it out. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's such an honored tradition out of which, you know, from Aeschylus on forward, on to Tolstoy, you know, every happy family's the same, every unhappy family, well, that's a story that needs to be told. Mm-hmm. And I feel that if you are willing to enter upon the path with compassion rather than vengeance, if the story is of that nature, mm-hmm. then by all means do it, because I think it is a transformative journey just mm-hmm. trying to do it right.
And I also have the sense that in your case, this collection is much more a tribute to your parents than any sort of expose or criticism.
I hope so. I think so.
Yeah.
I very much tried that to make that the case.
I think I would like to ask you to read one more poem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's called Thaw.
Mm-hmm. Thaw. On a March Monday so mild, the season songbirds sing. She puts on her galoshes and passes down on old crusted snow to the hollow. Leaving the path, the sunbathed bowl of meadow, and the noisy road where trucks and cars rush past, she steps into the stand of pines like the deer that sleep beneath its boughs. Standing still in that quiet cover, awakening to the grove's hidden life, she soon hears the invisible stream, threading toward it through the thawing, slipping, catching a bare branch. She follows the sound down to a pool where silver trickles over ice. There, she lies down on a bed of fallen needles and gazes up through the intricate etchings of bare limbs toward the green-needled height. She thinks maybe she'll make a little room there, above the rusted floor, clearing some space, simplified and chaste. For now, it's enough to rest a while near the whispering, hearing again the world's pulse freed from loss.
I loved this poem. I loved the freedom of this moment in her life and the letting go. Did you write this after your father died?
Yes, I did.
Did you write this soon after your father died?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it was fairly soon. Yes, come to think of it, I think it was fairly soon after that.
And I don't know about the writing of it, but it felt like a moment in, her life, that would have been tied very specifically to an emotional...
Where the speaker has arrived at a kind of conclusion or a place of meditation.
Yeah, but because maybe of an event that has triggered or allowed this to happen.
Mm-hmm. A kind of arrival in a way, acceptance.
Right.
Yes, I think that is very much what the awakening is again, that you become alive to the living that's dancing around you all the time out in the natural world, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we get so locked into our emotional lives that we forget to look outward in that way. Mm-hmm. This poem tries to celebrate that that time, that moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It felt very much like a release.
Yes, a deliverance. Mm-hmm. I think so, definitely.
Well, Pamela, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That, again, was a conversation with the Vermont poet Pamela Harrison. Hope you enjoyed that. Next week, tune in to hear a conversation with New Hampshire author Toby Ball, whose new novel, The Vaults, has been called an impressive thriller debut by Publishers Marketplace. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Pamela Harrison. In her creative writing classes, she will sometimes ask students to read and study Archibald MacLeish's poem 11, which captures a particular time in the intellectual and emotional life of an 11-year-old boy. He is asked by the adults in his life to think, think, oh, think, but he's not ready to think. He's still living deep inside his body. He hasn't arrived at his intellectual capacities, and he hasn't awakened yet to his separate self. The poem, says Pamela Harrison, beautifully captures that time in the life of a child. So your prompt this week is to find the poem 11 by Archibald MacLeish and read it. I was able to find it on Google. Look at each line as it develops. And then try to recall a place in your own childhood where you felt most comfortable with yourself, a hiding place perhaps, a secret place, and then write about that. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. Finally, if you have comments about Write the Book or news about book-related events in the local Burlington area, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. And you can find more information about The Radiator online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby is here in the studio, and she's going to bring you the world of music just about right away. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.